Welcome to the C-Suite. I'm Elizabeth Gordon, and you're listening to Business Radio X. Today, we have Monty Hamilton here with Rural Sourcing, Inc., RSI. Rural Sourcing, Inc. provides a competitive onshore alternative to the traditional answers of IT outsourcing. So everybody's heard of outsourcing, and usually when you think of outsourcing, you think of going to India or China or some of these low-cost places on the other side of the world from where we are here in Atlanta. And Rural Sourcing does something quite different, and we're going to hear all about it from Mr. Monty Hamilton, who is the CEO. Welcome to the show, Monty.
Thank you, Elizabeth. It's great to be here.
It's terrific to have you. So you actually have been with the company for a while. You founded the original company and then through acquisition then became the CEO of what's now RSI, correct?
Sort of, yeah, very close.
Why don't you tell me the story so I don't flub it here?
No, it's close. So I am a founder of the parent company called Clarkston Consulting, and we did buy Rural Sourcing 3 years ago, 3.5 years ago now. And when we did, I honestly fell in love with the business model and the idea and the concept and said, you know, if we're going to buy that company, I have to run it. So it's been a great ride for the last 3.5 years.
So when you first started looking at building your own consulting firm with other partners, where were you guys focused on in terms of like the opportunities that existed in the marketplace?
Yeah, sure. Interesting story going back now, I'll say 100 years ago, not quite that long, but a good number of years ago. I started my career directly across the street here from your studio at what was then Anderson Consulting. We being four other partners and I, met in New York on a project. We were doing SAP implementation work, which is a big ERP package out there. Most executives are familiar with because they spend a lot of money putting it in.
Right.
And we had gotten some experience in doing that for a couple of clients, decided that this thing might have some legs, and this was back in the early 90s before SAP really was that well known here in the U.S. Decided that we could make a business of this, or at least we'd try, and we left our comfortable home at that point in time with Accenture and jumped out and hung our own shingle out. Today, Clarkston Consulting is about a 300-person consulting firm with offices across the U.S. And one in Europe as well, doing great work along SAP in specifically for them within the pharmaceutical and consumer packaged goods industry.
Okay, so what is it that you saw when you noticed that a lot of companies were making the switch to using offshore resources? Why did you think, hey, you know what, maybe that's not going to go down so well for them, or maybe there's another way of looking at the idea of low-cost labor?
Sure. Yeah, well, we actually had our own experience with offshore within Clarkston. We created our own offshore captive center in Bangalore. We had two offices, one in Mumbai and Bangalore, in the late 90s. And the success was difficult, right? So we did make it work, but it took a lot of manpower, a lot of people working odd-hour shifts to overcome the time zone differences, to overcome the cultural differences and the language barriers, right? We made it work, but it wasn't easy. And when we look back on it for our clients and for ourselves, it wasn't nearly as inexpensive as we thought, as long as we were being honest with ourselves and look at the total cost, right? And so through that experience, we realized that this is a difficult thing to do, right? To manage a team, to do software development, which
is complex. I mean, you're not talking about baking cookies.
It is not cookie cutter at all, right? It's as much art as it is science, right? And so to do that with all those hurdles in your way, the culture, the language, the time zone differences, we realized that if we could take the idea of saving money, and doing that here in the U.S. in some lower-cost locations, and then overcome those language barriers, those cultural barriers, those time zone barriers, we might have a cost-competitive alternative to offshore. And so, hence, Rural Sourcing became an idea that we were very much interested in. We found a company who had started in this business in 2004. It was founded by a former CIO out of Baxter Healthcare, who like us, had had mixed success with her own initiatives and going offshore, and decided that when she retired, she would take some of her severance package and go and start this company to leverage some of the talent that she knew existed, in her case, in Northeast Arkansas.
Well, with job creation in the U.S., you know, for the last couple of years, but, you know, even heightened focus on right now, you guys have been in the news a lot. A lot of people are really catching on to this idea of using onshore resources as still a low-cost way to meet their IT needs. Why do you think it's so relevant right now, and where do you see it going in the future?
Yeah, great question. So there, I think there, if you look at the big categories of drivers for this, they'll fall into one of three categories. Economics being number one, right? Number two being the risk profile of taking data and your patented licensed software offshore. And the third is social, political environment that we're in. And if you dig into each one of those three, so from an economic point of view, the inflation rate today in India in the last 3 years has been somewhere between 15 and 20% for IT workers, making it very competitive to keep those personnel.
Right. Because those low costs are growing at quite a pace.
That gap has narrowed considerably, really, in the last 3 years. And then companies have gotten a lot smarter about the productivity rates, right? How many times do I have to do this to get it right the way I want it, right? And to do that, again, if you're dealing with cultural barriers, language barriers, time zone barriers, it's very, very difficult to get that thing right the first time. So most mature companies now realize I'm going to have to pad some additional iterations here to go over this thing once, twice, maybe three times to get it right. Whereas in our model, the idea is that quality right the first time, right? We want to get it done correctly. We don't have those language barriers. We can work with the engineers at the client site to get those things done. So all those economics sort of are working in our favor these days, the weakened dollar as well. And if you look at the second category of risk, working as many companies, especially intellectual property companies, have found that it's difficult to protect those rights when you go to many of the Asian countries such as China and India because of the law. The laws there are not as well known.
Right. Patents and copyrights, trademarks.
Not as well respected over there, right? So so that's a huge issue.
Asia is. It's a completely different business climate. So companies that grew up with that U.S. mentality of you invent it, you own it,
right,
have a hard time figuring out how that plays
culturally
in the world's biggest economy now.
That's correct. Culturally, it's just not the same. That's not the way they grew up, as you put it, and it's not the way the laws are interpreted. And so it makes it very difficult to protect those rights, especially if you think about startup software companies, early stage software companies, who that's all they have is that piece of intellectual property. And if that's lost to the market, they're not going to recover.
Okay. So from a risk standpoint, keeping things within the U.S. framework
correct
helps to mitigate that.
Both from intellectual property as well as the data itself, right? So there are a number of industries that absolutely prevent their data, their source data, such as your Social Security number from your hospital or your healthcare provider, going offshore. Those companies, those are still pressed from an economic point of view to bring down their IT cost. So if they can't go offshore to get those lower rates, what's their alternative? And we think we fit that bill pretty well.
Now, as the CEO of RSI, you're responsible for leading the strategic direction and the growth and launching 30 new high-tech hubs across the U.S. How's that going?
That's our BHAG goal, right? Our big, hairy, audacious goal. And it's going great. So, Elizabeth, we have been, like I said, we bought the company 3 years ago, and as we sort of inside joke, we had, you know, 10 people in a tin shack in Arkansas. Wasn't quite that way, but it was pretty close. We had a great group of core people there to build on. Just to give you an example of how we've accelerated that growth this year so far, we've hired 60 people. Between April and really the end of May.
That's pretty impressive.
So, yeah, so we're making our way there. We'll start our most recent development center was in Augusta, so just
okay.
A couple hours east of here. our commitment there is to bring 100 jobs to that location. I believe that we can probably double that over there in that location. We're well on our way to closing in on that 100 people. By the fourth quarter or by the end of this year, we should be there, at which point we'll go and look for another center somewhere here in the U.S. Most likely, I'd love to be able to cover the mountain time zone in somewhere in the Idaho, Colorado, Utah area. But currently, we're serving clients across the U.S., and so sometimes that makes it a little late nights for our folks on the East Coast and Augusta to stay there.
Right. But we service those Californians.
Yeah, that's right. In fact, I just came back yesterday from there. But we're doing great in terms of the growth. The idea has been catching on really within the last 12 months. Thanks to folks like you who are willing to give us some publicity and put us out there. And I think that the general population of CIOs and IT executives sees now some of the certainly they see the pendulum swinging back this way of what makes sense. We're not going to replace all the IT jobs in Bangalore. We're not going to bring those
right
back.
Well, it doesn't make sense to me. I mean, that has a place, but it Absolutely. Can't necessarily be the whole solution for let's move all our IT to Bangalore.
No, that's right. That's right. And in fact, many of our clients now realize what they can leave in Bangalore and what they can't. And for those things that they can't that need higher touch, higher collaboration with their maybe internal staff or even with their customers. Those are the things where we fit the bill very nicely.
So what are, for our audience who might not be familiar with, making offshore and decisions, what are the functions that companies usually look at to outsource in an organization? And how do they make those decisions? Is it based on, the strategy of the company? How does that...
Well, if you look back at the history of offshore outsourcing, and the two are not synonymous, right? Companies have been doing outsourcing for forever. It's just the advent of offshore became very popular, initially starting with the manufacturing world, right, and setting up manufacturing facilities in China and Asia, other places there, to take advantage of the low cost of labor. That, with the Y2K issues or opportunities, I'll say, in the late 90s, forced companies to look at it from an IT point of view. And that really kicked off the whole India movement, that and Jack Welch at GE, frankly, to start looking at that as a well-educated nation that had good technical skills and a lot of population who were willing to work for very little money. So that was one of the other areas. The other two areas of significance from an outsourcing and offshore specifically point of view is the business process outsourcing. So a lot of your back office activities, whether it's accounts payable or accounts receivable activities that are more cookie cutter processes that can be sort of dumbed down to move stack A to stack B, and you can do that at your lowest cost provider.
Right. You don't have to be on site in the company. It's not tied to their core value proposition.
Correct. And you don't have to have a lot of contextual knowledge of the company itself or a lot of real true understanding of their place in the market. The other area, which has become famous because of sort of the iconoclastic Peggy commercials, right, have been the call centers, right, that Bobby Bowden and Lou Holtz have made famous, right? And that's anytime I begin to tell someone outside the IT industry what we do, that's immediately
where
they go, right? Now, in our particular business, we don't do call center work.
Okay.
However, there are plenty of companies here in the U.S. today that are following the same model of lower cost labor. In the Dakotas has been great at doing this, right? In fact, the Dakotas are the only two states in the union that have had less than 5% unemployment during this last recession. So
it's been a real lifesaver for
their
economy.
They have done very well with it.
So these rural markets that you're going into from an economic development aspect, what we hear is that a lot of, if you go outside of major metropolitans, those smaller economic sectors have been hit even harder during this recession. So, I mean, are they welcoming you guys with open arms and thrilled to have you there?
I couldn't ask for a better support structure in Augusta and Jonesboro, where we have our two of our development centers. I couldn't possibly ask for anything else that I haven't been given already. They've been super supportive. In fact, when we were doing our search looking for another center, and Augusta won out in that, I remember sitting down with the mayor, Deke Copenhaver, president of one of the universities there, as well as the economic development group. And I wasn't, Elizabeth, 15 seconds into my pitch about what we were going to do, and the mayor just cut me off. He said, "I get it. You're going to keep 100 of my young, bright, college graduate people here in Augusta, making a good salary, living downtown, patronizing the other businesses downtown. What do you need from me?" So it was fantastic.
That's right. Great.
And it wasn't just a line support that he shot me to sell me the business. He's been super supportive every time we've asked him for something, even after we've decided to move there. So
what do you look for when you're trying to figure out what's a good location? Obviously, a work, you know, an educated workforce. What are some of the other factors?
Yeah, so one is a low cost of living. So we're looking at places where just out of the gate, I can have probably a 20 to 25% cost advantage from a cost of living point of view, relative to an Atlanta. If you take that to a Boston, New York, or versus Silicon Valley in the West Coast, then that cost advantage is going to be 40, 50%.
Right. We live pretty good here in Atlanta.
We do. It's not too bad. It's not too bad. But we can find better, and we have. And,
right.
So the other thing is, you said, is an educated workforce. I can't really the level of sophisticated software development that we do, I can't really take someone who is just off the street and doesn't have some background in software development and turn them into one of our software developers or software engineers. I can take those people who have had some formal training, some engineering background, and then put them through our own training, which we do, to allow them to do some great software development and software support work.
So you do offer training to employees as they progress, and even really a career progression.
Yeah, absolutely.
A little bit about that.
Yeah, so I have to say I probably have the best job in the world. I get up every morning with the opportunity to go out there and create some jobs and really give folks in these communities who have decided for typically family reasons, this is where they're going to live. They could move to Atlanta. They could go get a job in Boston or New York, anywhere they wanted to. IT help is in huge demand. So they could leave and go do that. But they've chosen, for various and sundry reasons, that this is where they want to live and this is where they want to raise their family.
Right.
And so I get the opportunity to come in there and give these guys a chance and some confidence to do the kind of work that they do. And I always think about if some of your listeners are football fans. A couple of years ago, Aaron Rodgers, who's the quarterback of the Green Bay Packers, who was the Super Bowl MVP in the year they won. Out of high school, Aaron Rodgers was not drafted by any college in the U.S. So no college in the U.S. decided that Aaron Rodgers was good enough to play for them. The only opportunity he had was to go to Butte Community College near Chico, California, as a quarterback there. And during the Super Bowl that year, they talked to his community college coach, and they interviewed him and said, you know, what did you give Aaron Rodgers to enable him to play at such a high level and achieve all that he's achieved at this point? And he looked at the camera and he said, look, I didn't give Aaron Rodgers anything. He had all the skills, all the capabilities necessary to be successful at any level when he set foot on this campus, with the exception of one thing. I gave him confidence. I gave him confidence he could go out there and compete with anybody in this country and do what he does best. And that's what we do. We take talented people and give them an opportunity to do some great work and live where they want to live, right?
Right. Oftentimes, it used to be that you had to make a choice. If you wanted the high-powered, successful job, you had to live in a market where those kinds of companies were.
That's right, and I think we're changing as a not just what we're doing, but as a country in terms of being better at working from your home, right? Telecommuting, working from wherever you live. I don't know how many executives I meet and talk to where their company headquarters may be in one location, yet they live in a completely different location, right? Because people are so mobile these days. And frankly, to that point, I think that's one of the reasons, Elizabeth, I fell in love with this business. I grew up in a small two-stoplight hamlet in northeast Mississippi, right? And so none of those jobs existed, right? The best thing you could hope for was to get a job at the shoe factory and maybe you could be a foreman there, right? And that's kind of all I knew until I got a little education and moved away and saw that there were other opportunities out there. But the thing I love about what we do is that we provide models for these people to see and understand what does it mean to be a software engineer? What does it mean to be a software developer? How do I rise up in the ranks? How can I get into building apps for the iPhone, right? And so we provide that outlet for these talented people, and they are phenomenally dedicated and loyal and very appreciative of the opportunity.
Nice. What types of projects do you do for your clients? And what types of clients do you have?
Yeah. So the latter question first, the types of clients range everywhere from your Silicon Valley-based software entrepreneur who's got a great idea and wants to build the software, but again, he doesn't want to take it outside the U.S. for fear of losing his intellectual property, to Fortune 100 companies, retailers such as SuperValu and J.Crew. And so there's a pretty wide girth, if you will,
right,
of kinds of companies that we work with. And the kinds of work that we do for them range anywhere, again, from the SAP support work. So we will help companies who have put in or implemented their SAP systems and now have decided that they need some help to support those long term and help that is not quite as expensive as they might find in other locations.
Right.
The other stuff is that we have built mobile apps for companies who want to take advantage of some of the new applications and platforms that are out there. We have built a lot of custom-developed software for companies that are wanting to modernize their businesses. They've had old platforms, old technology that's just not cutting it these days. And so we take those old platforms and old software systems and convert them to some of the newer technologies today.
Now, as the CEO, where do you find – I know you spend your time doing a little bit of everything, but obviously – there are some things that are higher priorities than others. So
sure.
Where do you find that you really focus the majority of your efforts on the business growth plans?
I try to, and I think fairly successfully, spend as much time as I can with clients, right? Whether that be talking about opportunities with them or understanding how we're meeting or not meeting their needs in some cases, right? So we're all about continuous improvement. And the more time I can spend with our clients, in fact, as I mentioned, I was just on the West Coast yesterday. And the work we're doing for this particular client in the entertainment industry has been awesome. They had worked with another partner offshore. That did not work out so well. And so we've transitioned that support of a software system, in this case a customer relationship system, to rural sourcing, and they couldn't have been more pleased. Even after, and it's really only been three months now, the turnaround in what we're able to do, the quickness, the agility of it, we're able to respond to their needs and get things done. And so it was fantastic to go out there and get to a chance to talk to those people and then hopefully relay that back to my colleagues who are out there doing the real hard work, really.
Right. So you've got a great team in place. How do you keep the unified vision of the organization in place? How do you nurture talent within your own company and bring out the best of the people that are on the RSI team?
Sure. My biggest secret to that, Elizabeth, honestly, is to hire well. You've had the opportunity to meet a couple of my staff, and I couldn't do any of the stuff the fun job that I get, I couldn't do without them. As I say, I get to go out and make all the promises, and they get to make sure they get executed on the back end, right? But I've been very, very fortunate and blessed to say that we've hired a great management team here in Atlanta. And then we've got great leadership in each of our development centers, and then just a host of talented software professionals who, again, love what they do. They love sitting behind the keyboards and solving the client's problems.
Now, as a leader in the organization, I'm curious how you develop yourself as well. I mean, nobody teaches you how to be a CEO in college, no matter how many degrees you get. So how do you learn how? How have you learned how to take on this challenging role?
I think probably by making a lot of mistakes. When we bought the business, I came in and I had some preconceived notions of what we would do and how we would do it. I'll say I was probably wrong on about 9 out of 10 of those. But I think
as long as you're aware of that,
I was going to say one of my strong suits, yeah, is to listen, right, and to find those people that I do trust and who have good insights and good ideas, and we have a very collaborative organization. All of our team gets together on a regular, frequent basis. We all work here in the Atlanta office when we're not traveling. And so it's very informal that we yell down the hall, and we're quick this way to get decisions made, and we think arrive at the best decisions possible. But I do try to read a lot. I try to learn from those who have published out there. This past summer, I read the Steve Jobs book, as well as the Howard Schultz, the founder and comeback CEO at Starbucks, which was one of my favorite companies, and I spend a heck of a lot of money with them every day.
You're not alone.
No, and I know they're excited in Augusta because Augusta actually has recruited in a Starbucks over there that will be doing the manufacturing for their Via products. So they're excited, and I'm excited about having Starbucks there locally as well.
Right, it should increase productivity.
Absolutely.
A little caffeine always.
Doesn't hurt one iota. Between that and some Red Bull, and we're good to go.
Now, Monty, how do companies find out that you guys are out there as an option? How do you go to market?
Yeah, so I end up, because we are somewhat of the Kleenex brand in this industry, but having the rural sourcing name, the industry does refer to
right.
the idea of onshore or domestic sourcing as rural sourcing by and large. So we get a lot of incoming phone calls and interest from people who Google it.
Rural sourcing.
And gosh, there's the,
right,
there's the company
it's
with
a
the
generic
name. That's
and
right.
There you go.
So we're, and that was one of the things I didn't do early on, Elizabeth, so I didn't change the name. Right. So I made at least one good decision.
That was smart.
But we, I do end up speaking at a lot of conferences, a lot of outsourcing conferences, a lot of IT conferences, whether they be specific to outsourcing or to other technology areas. And so the idea of just getting the concept out there, and I would say we probably haven't reached 70% of our audience yet with the idea that this is out there, though it's beginning to catch on. Certainly the analysts, the advisors in the IT space now know quite a bit about us. We've spent a good bit of time with them. Gartner specifically has issued some reports on the whole idea of lowercase rural sourcing and what it means and the growth of that industry. There's some other people who follow the industry very closely who have written a lot about this space. And so it's beginning to catch on. But I'd still say conservatively, we probably haven't reached 70% of our target audience out there, that this is a very viable, cost-effective alternative to taking this work offshore.
Now, when you're selling an engagement to the CEO or the CIO in that company, what are the pieces of the value proposition that they really resonate with?
Multiple fronts. One is most have been around long enough to know that the offshore model is difficult. Right?
So some have already gone down that path.
They have, and they've decided that as we said before, some of the things they do, it works fine for, okay for. But other things, it's just very difficult. And we've had probably about half of our business comes from clients who are moving work back here in the U.S., and the other half is brand new stuff. In many cases, they haven't done the offshore model yet. However, they still need to figure out a way to lower their IT costs. They're constantly getting bombarded and pressured by their CFO or CEO to bring down that cost of IT. And so we become a very easy step for those CIOs to take initially to say, here's an alternative where I can save 40-50% of what I would spend normally to bring in outside consultants and do it this way. And let's see, it's a lot less risky, a lot easier to manage, a lot easier to fly in and put your hands on the people who are doing the work. And so I think for those reasons, we've become a great alternative.
Right. Nobody's IT costs are naturally going down. They're all on the rise because now IT, it used to be one department. now it's everywhere. It touches every department.
It is ubiquitous, right? Everything that you do has a component to it. In fact, I had the opportunity to speak to a group of juniors and seniors at Augusta State in their business college there. So these weren't the people that we normally hire because they come out of the computer science or engineering backgrounds. But these are the business, the marketing, the finance majors. And the one thing that I gave them, I think that hopefully maybe it would have stuck, that even if they're not programming that software, they've got to have an appreciation for what it can do for them to make them successful. And frankly, this period in time where we are with social media, with mobile, with big data, and all these other things that are going on out there in the IT world, it's a great place to be, regardless of what your profession is, whether it's finance or marketing or PR. There's very little unemployment in the technology sector. It is unlike the rest of the U.S., and I think I saw a statistic the other day where maybe just over 4% unemployment if you look at the IT sector.
Nice. But there's definitely that continuous need for those on the business side to understand and be working hand in hand with those on the technology side.
Absolutely. And it may not be far from the day where, you know, the IT shop really is hard to put your hands on, right? It becomes more like the blob that seeped into every department, right?
Right.
And everybody's responsible for doing something. And that's one of the big debates out there today is, you know, all about the current generation of bring your own device and software as a service, right, and hosting your data center somewhere else, right? So the fluidity of the IT department is unbelievable today compared to where it was just 5 years ago.
Now, what challenges do you face or have you faced as you grow the company?
I think by and large, the largest is being somewhat the pioneer out here, right? So the pioneers were the ones that with the the initial arrows in the back, right?
Right. You got to carve the path. The road is.
That's right. So I think
not
going
already
out,
paved no, for you,
and doing some of that evangelizing. But it's easy once you sit down and talk to an IT professional about what we're doing and why we're doing it. You can see the light bulbs go off immediately. But the big that was certainly the biggest hurdle this term is just getting the word out. I appreciate you guys having us today and giving us a platform to talk about creating jobs in the U.S. for places that wouldn't otherwise have them.
Absolutely. So what can we expect in terms of growth on the horizon? What does the next 12 to 18 months look like for you?
Yeah, so when I came home from Augusta and I was all excited about having opened up the center over there a little over a year ago and we were been on the local news and the next day we had probably 400 resumes hit our database because of the exposure. I was so pumped up about it. And one of my sons looked at me and said, "Dad, that's great. You know what? Only 27 more to go." So we have a little bit of work to do in front of us. However, we do believe that
family always keeps things in perspective for you, right? They ground you right down.
I was gonna say, if you don't have teenage children and you want some grounding, you're welcome to come talk to mine. The idea is that I think, you know, to date we've been growing at about a 300% annual clip. That will slow down at some point in time.
Right.
But over the next couple of years, we'll be able to continue to keep that pace. And that's all organic growth. The space itself continues to expand. And as I said before, I think we've really just scratched the surface so far of what we're capable of doing here with this model.
Nice. Well, it's exciting stuff, and it's been great talking with you, Monty. I want to make sure that people know where to find you online, and you guys – I have a website. Obviously, you've got some social media stuff in there. What's the best way for if somebody wants to find out more about RSI for them to reach out and contact?
Yeah, go to the website, www.ruralsourcing.com. Look for us. Google us. We appear on the first several pages, so it shouldn't be too hard to find us.
Fantastic. Well, we wish you all the best, and thanks for checking in on the C-Suite and telling us about the exciting growth plans for the business.
Hey, it was my pleasure. Thank you very much.
This is Elizabeth Gordon with Business Radio X, and we will talk to you next week.